books tonight. Tomorrow is okay for the story. Thank you, her mother said, but no. Come. She turned crisply on her heel and walked away. Meredith and Nina had to rush along behind her through the busy passageways. They went into their own room and changed into sweats. Meredith had just finished brushing her teeth when Nina came up alongside her, touching her shoulder. I'm going to show her the picture and ask who the children are. I don't think it's a good idea. That's because you're a nice girl who follows the rules and tries to be polite. She grinned. I'm the other sister. You can say you knew nothing about it. Will you trust me on this? Sure, Meredith finally said. They left their stateroom and went next door. Mom opened the door and led them into her spacious suite. As expected, the cabin was as neat as a pin. No clothes lay about, no personal items were anywhere. The only unexpected find was a pot of tea and 3 cups on the coffee table. Mom poured herself a cup of tea and then went to a club chair positioned in the corner of the room. She sat down and put a blanket over her lap. Meredith sat in the love seat opposite her. Before you turn out the lights, Nina said, I have something to show you, Mom. Mom looked up. Yes. Nina moved closer. In what felt to Meredith like slow motion, Nina pulled the photograph out of her pocket and handed it to Mom. Mom drew in a sharp breath. What little color her face held drained away. You went through my things? We know the fairy tale takes place in Leningrad, and that some of it is real. Who is Vera, Mom? Nina asked. And who are these children? Mom shook her head. Do not ask me. We're your daughters, Meredith said gently, trying to soften the questions her sister had asked. We just want to know you. It was what Dad wanted, too, Nina said. Mom stared down at the photograph, which vibrated in her shaking hand. The room went so still they could hear the waves hitting the boat far below. You are right. This is no fairy tale. But if you want to hear the rest of it, you will allow me to tell the story in the only way I can. But who? No questions, Nina. Just listen. Mom might have looked pale and tired, but her voice was pure steel. Nina sat down by Meredith, holding her hand. Okay. Okay, then. Mom leaned back in the seat. Her finger moved over the photo, feeling its slick surface. For once, the lights were on as she started to speak. Vera fell in love with Sasha on that day in the summer garden. And for her, this is a decision that will never change. Even though her mother disagrees, is afraid of Sasha's love of poetry, Vera is young and passionately in love with her husband. And when their first child is born, it seems like a miracle. Anastasia, they name her, and she is the light of Vera's life. When Leo is born the next year, Vera cannot imagine that it is possible to be happier, even though it is a bad time in the Soviet Union. The world knows this. They know of Stalin's evil. People are disappearing and dying. No one knows this better than Vera and Olga, who still cannot safely say their father's name. But in June of 1941, it is impossible to worry. Or so it seems to Vera, as she kneels in the rich black earth and tends her garden. Here, on the outskirts of the city, she and Sasha have a small plot of land where they grow vegetables to carry them through the long white Leningrad winter. Vera still works in the library, while Sasha studies at university, learning only what Stalin allows. They become good Soviets, or at least quiet ones, for the black vans are everywhere these days. Sasha is only a year away from finishing his degree, and he hopes to find a teaching position at one of the universities. Mama, look! Leo calls out to her, holding up a tiny orange carrot, more root still than vegetable. Vera knows she should chastise him, but his smile is so infectious that she is lost. At 4, he has his father's golden curls and easy laugh. Put the carrot back, Leo. It still needs time to grow. I told him not to pull it up, says 5-year-old Anya, who is as serious as her brother is joyous. And you are right, Vera says, struggling not to smile. Though she is only 22 years old, the children have turned her into an adult. It is only when she and Sasha are alone that they are really still young. When Vera finishes with her garden, she gathers up her children, takes one in each hand, and begins the long walk back to their apartment. It is late afternoon by the time they return to Leningrad, and the streets are crowded with people running and shouting. At first, Vera thinks it is just the Belia Noche that has energized everyone. But as she reaches the Fontanka Bridge, she begins to hear snippets of conversation, the start of a dozen arguments, a buzz of anxiety. She hears a squawking sound coming through a speaker and the word attention thrown like a knife into wood. Clutching the children's hands, she wades into the crowd just as the announcement begins. Citizens of the Soviet Union, at 4 a.m., without declaration of war, German troops have attacked our country. The announcement goes on and on, telling them to be good Soviets, to enlist in the Red Army, to resist the enemy, but Vera cannot listen to any more. All she can think is that she must get home. The children are crying long before Vera gets back to the apartment near the Moika embankment. She hardly hears them. Though she is a mother, holding her own baby's hands, she is a daughter, too, and a wife, and it is her mother and husband whom she wants to see now. She takes her children up the dirty staircase, down hallways that are frighteningly quiet. In their own apartment, no lights are on, so it takes her eyes a moment to adjust. Mama and Olga, still dressed in their work clothes, are at one of the windows, taping newsprint over the glass. At Vera's return, her mother stumbles back from the window she's been covering, saying, "Thank God!" and takes Vera in her arms. "We have things to do quickly," Mama says, and Olga finishes the window and comes over. Vera can see that Olga has been crying. Her freckled cheeks are tracked in tears, and her strawberry blonde hair is a mess. Olga has a nervous habit of pulling at her own hair when she is afraid. "Vera," Mama says briskly, "you take Olga and go to the store. Buy whatever you can that will last. Buckwheat, honey, sugar, lard, anything. I will run to the bank and get out all our money." Then she kneels in front of Leo and Anya. "You will stay here alone and wait for us to return." Anya immediately whines.
"I want to go with you, Baba."
Mama touches Anya's cheek. Things are different now, even for children. She gets to her feet and grabs her purse from the other room, checking to make sure that her blue passbook is there. The three of them leave the apartment, closing the door behind them, hearing the lock click into place. From the other side, there is crying almost immediately. Vera looks at her mother.
"I cannot just leave them here, locked in."
"From now on, you will do many unimaginable things," her mother says tiredly. "Now let us go before it is too late." Outside, the sky is a beautiful cloudless blue, and the lilacs that grow beneath the first floor windows scent the air. It seems impossible that war hangs over Leningrad on a day like this, until they turn the corner and come to the bank, where people are jammed together in a crowd at the closed door, waving their passbooks in the air and screaming. Women are crying, We are too late already, Mama says.
What is happening? Olga asks, pulling nervously at her hair again, looking around.
Beside her, an elderly woman makes a moaning sound and thumps to the ground in a heap. In seconds, she is lost amid the crowd.
The banks are closed for now. Too many people tried to take out their money.
Mama chews on her lower lip until blood appears and then leads them down to the grocers. Here, people are leaving with whatever they can carry. The shelves are practically empty. Already prices are doubling and tripling.
Vera has trouble making sense of this.
War has just been announced, and yet the supplies are gone already, and the people around her look dazed and desperate.
We have been here before, Mama says simply.
In the store, they have only enough money for buckwheat, flour, dried lentils, and lard. Carrying their meager supplies back through the crowded streets, they make it to the apartment at just past 6. Vera can hear her children crying, and it breaks her heart. She opens the door and scoops them up. Leo throws his arms around her neck and hangs on, saying, "I missed you, Mama!" Vera thinks then that she will never again follow her mother's advice about this one thing. She will never leave her children alone.
"Where is your papa?"
she asks Anya, who shrugs her small shoulders.
"He should have been home by now."
"I'm sure he's fine," her mother says. "It will be difficult to get through the streets." Worry gnaws at Vera, though, sharpening its bite with every passing minute. Finally, at 8 o'clock, he comes into the apartment. The side of his face is dirty, and his hair is damp with sweat.
"Verushka," he says, pulling her into his arms, holding her so tightly she cannot breathe. "The trolleys were full. I ran all the way here. Are you okay?"
"Now we are," she says. And she believes it.
That night, while her grandmother snores in the hot darkness, Vera sits up in her bed. The big crisscross of tape and newsprint on the windows lets only the merest light through. Beyond it, the city is strangely, eerily silent. It is as if Leningrad itself has drawn in a sharp breath and is afraid to exhale. In this shadowy darkness, their apartment seems even smaller and more jumbled. With 3 narrow beds in the living area and the children's cots in the kitchen, there is barely room to walk in here anymore. Even at mealtimes, they cannot all be together. There isn't enough room at the table or chairs to go around it. Not far away, Mama and Olga are awake too, sitting up in their bed. Beside Vera, Sasha is as silent as she's ever seen him.
"I don't know what we're supposed to do," Olga says.
At 19, she should be thinking of love and romance and her future, not war.
"Maybe the Germans will save us. Comrade Stalin..."
"Shh," Mama says sharply, glancing over at her sleeping mother. "Some things can never be said aloud. Olga should know this by now." "Tomorrow we will go to work," Mama says. "And the next day we do the same, and the next day after that. Now we must go to sleep. Here, Olga, roll over. I will hold you." Vera hears the squeaking of the tired bed as they settle down to sleep. She stretches out beside her husband, tries to feel safe in his arms. There is too little light to see his face clearly. He is just gray and black patches, but his breathing is steady and sure, and the sound of it, in rhythm to the beating of her heart, calms her down. She touches his cheek, feels the soft stubble of new growth, as familiar to her now as the wedding band she wears. She leans forward to kiss him, and for a moment, when his lips are on hers, there is nothing else. But then he draws back and says, "You will have to be strong, Verushka." We will be strong, she says, holding him in her arms. 2 nights later, they are awakened by gunfire. Vera launches out of bed, her heart pounding. She falls over her mother's bed as she tries to get to her children. Gunfire rattles the thin windows, and she can hear footsteps in the hallway and people screaming. Hurry, Sasha says, sounding surprisingly calm. He herds them all together, while Mama takes as much food as she can carry. It is not until they are outside in the street, huddled with the crowd of their neighbors beneath a pale blue sky, that they understand. These are Russian anti-aircraft guns, practicing for what is to come. There are no shelters on their street. It is Mama who organizes the people in her building. Tomorrow they will go to the storage area in the basement and make a shelter. Finally, amid the sound of gunfire and the preternatural silence between bursts, Sasha looks down at Vera. Leo is asleep in his arms. The boy can sleep through anything. And Anya is beside him, worriedly sucking her thumb and caressing the end of her blanket. It is a baby habit that was long gone before the start of the war and is now back. You know I have to go, Sasha says to Vera. She shakes her head, thinking suddenly that this gunfire means nothing. The look on her husband's face is infinitely more frightening. I am a university student and poet, he says, and you are the daughter of a criminal of the state. You haven't published any of your poetry. I am suspect, Vera, and you know this. So are you. You cannot go. I won't let you. It is done, Vera, is what he says. I joined the People's Volunteer Army. Mama is beside her then, clutching her arm. Of course you are going, Sasha, she says evenly, and Vera hears the warning in her mother's tone. Always it is about appearances. Even now, as the gunfire explodes all around them, a black van prowls in the street. It is the right thing to do, Sasha says. We are the Soviet Army, the best in the world. We will kick the Germans' asses in no time, and I will be home. Vera feels little Anya beside her, holding her hand, listening to every word, and so, too, their neighbors and even strangers. She knows what she is supposed to feel and to say, but doesn't know if she has the strength for it. Her father had once said to her much the same thing, "Do not worry, Veronika Petrovna. I will always be here for you." "Promise you'll come back to me," she says. "I promise," he says easily. But Vera knows. There are some promises that are pointless to ask for and useless to receive. When she turns to her mother, this truth passes between them, and Vera understands her own childhood. She will have to be strong for her children. It is a promise I will hold you to, Alexander Ivanovich. In the morning, she wakens early. In the quiet darkness, she finds her one photograph of them, taken on the day of their wedding. She looks down at their bright and smiling faces. Tears blur the image as she takes it out of the frame and folds it in half and then in half again. She tucks it in the pocket of his coat. She hears footsteps behind her, feels his hands on her shoulders. I love you, Verushka, he says softly, kissing the side of her face. She is glad he is behind her. She is not sure she has the strength to look him in the eyes when she says, I love you too, Sasha. Come back to me. In no time at all, he is gone. 19. Vera and Olga are lucky in their jobs. Olga works in the Hermitage Museum and Vera in the Leningrad Public Library. Now both of them spend their days in dark, quiet rooms, crating up masterpieces of art and literature so that the history of the Soviet state will never be lost. When work is over for the day, Vera walks home by herself. Sometimes she goes out of her way to see the summer garden and remember the day she met Sasha. But it is getting harder and harder to recall. Already the face of Leningrad is changing. The bronze horseman is covered in sandbags and wooden planks. Camouflage nets hang over the Smolny. Gray paint has been splashed over the golden spires of the Admiralty. Everywhere she looks, people are busy, building air raid shelters, standing in line for food, digging trenches. The skies overhead are still blue and cloudless, and no bombs have dropped on them yet. But it is coming, and they know it. Every day the speakers blare out reports of the advancements of the German troops. No one believes that the Germans will reach Leningrad, not their magical city built on mud and bones. But bombs will fall here. They have no doubt about that. On her way home, Vera stops by the bank and withdraws the 200 rubles she is allowed for the month. And when she has her money, she stands in line for 3 loaves of bread and a tin of cheese. Today she is lucky. There is food at the end of her long wait. Sometimes she gets to the front of the line only to see it close. When she finally gets home at 8 o'clock, she finds Anya and Leo playing war in the living room, jumping from bed to bed, making shooting sounds at each other.
Mama!
Leo cries when he sees her. His face breaks into a gummy grin, and he runs toward her, throwing himself in her arms. Anya is close on his heels, but she doesn't hug Vera so tightly. Anya is aggrieved by this business of war, and she wants everyone to know it. She does not like spending her days in nursery school, and not coming home until 6 o'clock, and then with smelly Mrs. Nevsky from next door. How are my babies? Vera asks, pulling Anya into her arms anyway. What did you two do in school today?
I am too old for baby school,
Anya informs her, scrunching her face in concentration. Vera pats her daughter's head and goes into the kitchen. She is at the stove, putting water on to boil, when Olga comes into the apartment.
Have you heard? She says breathlessly.
Vera turns around. What is it? Olga glances nervously at Anya and Leo, who are playing with sticks.
The children of Leningrad, she says, lowering her voice. They're being evacuated.
On the morning of the evacuation, Vera wakens feeling sick. She cannot do it. Cannot put her babies on a train bound for somewhere far away and then just go on with her life. She lies in bed, alone, as private a time as exists in this crowded apartment, staring up at the rust-stained, watermarked ceiling. She can hear her mother turning restlessly, and Olga snoring quietly in the bed only 2 feet away. Vera, Mama says. Vera turns onto her side. Mama is looking at her. They are close, in their side-by-side beds, almost close enough to touch. A threadbare blanket falls from Mama's shoulder when Olga rolls over. You cannot think it, she says. And Vera wonders if one day she will know what her children are thinking before they do.
How can I not? Vera says.
All her life she has understood what it is to be a good Soviet, how to follow the rules and keep one's head down and make no move that draws attention. But this, how can she blindly do this thing? Comrade Stalin has eyes everywhere. He is surely watching the Germans, and he knows where our children can go so that they will be safe. And all workers' children must go. That is all there is.
What if I don't see them again?
Mama peels back the cover and gets out of bed, crossing the tiny space between them. She gets into bed, takes Sasha's side, and pulls Vera into her arms, stroking her black hair as she used to when Vera was young. We women make choices for others, not for ourselves. And when we are mothers,
We bear what we must for our children. You will protect them. It will hurt you. It will hurt them. Your job is to hide that your heart is breaking and do what they need you to do.
Sasha told me I would have to be strong.
Mama nods. I don't think men understand, though. Even your Sasha. They march off with their guns and their ideas, and they think they know courage.
You're talking about Papa now.
Maybe I am.
They lay for a while longer without talking. For the first time in a long time, she is thinking about her father. As much as it hurts, it is better than dwelling on what is to come. She closes her eyes, and in the darkness, she is on the street in front of their old apartment, watching her papa leave. Her fingers are freezing beneath her woolen gloves, and her toes tingle with the cold.
I want to come to the cafe with you, she pleads, tilting her face up to him.
A light snow is falling around them. Flakes land on her bare cheeks.
He smiles down at her, his big black mustache beetling above his lip. This is no place for a girl. You know this, Verushka.
But you'll be reading your poetry. And Anna Akhmatova will be there. She is a woman.
Yes, he says, trying to look stern. A woman. You are still a girl. One day, he says, pressing a gloved hand to her shoulder, you will write your beautiful words. By then they will be teaching literature again in our schools, instead of this terrible Soviet realism that is Stalin's idea of progress. Be patient. Wave to me when I am across the street, and then go inside.
She stands there in the snow, watching him go. Tiny kisses of white fire land on her cheeks, almost immediately turning to spots of water that slide downward, slipping like cold fingers beneath her collar. Soon he is only a blur, a smear of gray wool moving in all that white. She thinks perhaps he has stopped to wave to her, but she cannot be sure. Instead, she sees how night falls on the snow, how it changes the color and textures. And she tries to place this in her memory so that she can describe it in her journal.
Do you remember when I used to dream of being a writer? Vera says quietly now.
It is a long time before her mother says, even more softly, I remember all of it.
Maybe someday,
shh. Her mother says, stroking her hair. It will only hurt more. This I know.
Vera hears the disappointment in Mama's voice, and the acceptance. Vera wonders if one day she will sound like that too, if it will seem easier to give up. Before she can think of what to say, she hears Leo in the kitchen. No doubt he is talking to the stuffed rabbit that is his best friend. Vera thinks, it has begun. She feels her mother's kiss, hears words whispered at her ear, but she cannot understand them. The roar in her head is too loud. She eases out from the bed and sits up. Although this morning is warm, as was the night before, she is dressed in a skirt and a sweater. A battered pair of shoes waits at the end of the bed. They are all sleeping in their clothes now. An air raid can come at any time. The sound of movements overtake the small apartment. Olga whines that she is still sleepy, and her arms ache from loading art into boxes. Her grandmother blows her nose. Anya informs everyone that she is hungry.
It is all so ordinary.
Vera swallows the lump that is formed in her throat, but it will not go away. In the kitchen, she sees Leo, the spitting image of his father, with angelic golden curls and expressive green eyes.
Leo, her lion.
He is laughing now, telling his poor one-eyed tattered rabbit
that maybe they will get to feed the swans in the summer garden today.
It is war,
Anya says, looking impossibly superior for a 5-year-old. Her lisp turns the sentence into something softer, but all of Anya's fire is in her eyes. She is pure steel, this girl, exactly how Vera once imagined herself to be.
Actually, Vera says,
we are going on a walk. She feels physically ill when she says it, but her mother comes up behind her. With a touch, Vera can go on. She crosses the room and picks up their coats. Last night, Vera stayed up late, sewing money and letters into the lining of her baby's coats. Leo is on his feet in an instant, gleefully clapping his hands, saying, "Walk!" over and over. Even Anya is smiling. It has only been 5 days since the announcement of war, but in those days their old life has disappeared. Breakfast passes like a funeral procession, in quiet glances and lowered gazes. No one except Mama can look at Vera. At the end of the meal, her grandmother rises. When she looks at Vera, her eyes fill with tears and she turns away.
Come, Zoya, her grandmother says in a harsh voice. It does not look good to be late.
Vera can see that her mother's lip is bleeding from where she has bitten it. She goes to her grandchildren and kneels down, taking them in her arms and holding them.
Don't cry, Baba, Leo says. You can walk with us tomorrow.
Across the room, Olga bursts into tears and tries immediately to control herself.
I'm going now, Mama.
Mama lets go slowly and gets back to her feet.
Be good,
is the last thing she says to her grandchildren. She hands Vera 100 rubles.
It is all we have left.
I'm sorry. Vera nods and hugs her mother one last time. Then she straightens. Let's go, children. It is a beautiful sunny day. The six of them walk together for as long as they can. Mama and Baba leave first, turning toward the Badaev food warehouses where they both work. Olga leaves next. She hugs her niece and nephew fiercely and tries to hide her tears, and she runs toward her trolley stop. Now it is just Vera and her children, walking down the busy street. All around her, trenches are being dug. Shelters are being built. They stop in the summer garden, but the swans are gone from the pond, and the statues are sandbagged. There are no children playing here today. No bicycle rings bleating out. Smiling too brightly, Vera takes her children by the hands and leads them to a part of the city where they have never been. Inside the building that they enter, there is pandemonium. Queues snake through the hall in every direction, flowing away from desks overrun with paperwork, manned by party members in drab clothing with dour, disappointed faces. Vera knows they should go directly into the first processing queue and wait their turn, but suddenly she is not as strong as she needs to be. Taking a deep breath, she takes her children to a corner. It is not quiet here. The sounds of people are everywhere. Footsteps, crying, sneezing, begging. The whole place smells of body odor and onions and cured meat. Vera kneels down. Anya is frowning.
It smells in here, Mama. Comrade Floppy doesn't like this place,
Leo says, hugging his bunny. Do you remember when Papa went off to join the People's Volunteer Army, he told us we would all have to be strong?
I'm strong,
Leo says, showing off a pudgy pink fist.
Yes,
Anya says. She is suspicious now. Vera sees that her daughter is looking at the coats in Vera's arms and the suitcase she has brought from home. Vera takes the heavy red woolen coat and puts it on Anya, buttoning it up to her throat.
It is too hot for this, Mama,
Anya whines, wiggling.
You are going on a trip, Vera says evenly. Not for long, just a week or two. And you might need your coat. And here in this suitcase, I have packed a few more clothes and some food, just in case.
You are not wearing a coat, Anya says, frowning.
I have to work and stay at home. But you will be home before you know it, and I'll be waiting for you. When you get back, no, Anya says firmly. I don't want to go without you.
I don't want to,
Leo wails. We have no choice. You understand what this means? War is coming, and our great comrade Stalin wants you children to be safe. You're going to take a short train ride south until our Red Army triumphs. Then you will come home to Papa and me. Leo is crying now.
You want us to go? Anya asks, her blue eyes filling with tears.
No, Vera thinks, even as she nods. I need you to take care of your brother, she says. You are so strong and smart. You will stay with him always and never wander off, okay? Can you be strong for me?
Yes, Mama, Anya says.
For the next 5 hours, they stand in one queue after another. The children are processed and sorted and sent to other lines. By the end of the afternoon, the evacuation center is literally overrun with children and their mothers. But the place is strangely quiet. The children sit as they are told, their faces shiny with sweat in the coats they shouldn't need, their legs swinging in front of them. None of the mothers look at each other. It hurts too much to see your own pain reflected in another woman's eyes. And finally, the train arrives. Metal wheels scream. Smoke billows into the air. At first, the crowd just sits there. No one wants to move. But when the whistle pierces the silence, they run like a herd, mothers bustling past each other, elbowing hard, trying to get their baby seats on the train that will save them. Vera pushes her way to the front of the queue. The train seems alive beside her, breathing smoke, clanging. Party members patrol the area like sharks, forcing mothers to part with their children. Leo is sobbing, clutching Vera. Anya is crying too, but in a silent way that is somehow worse. Take care of each other and stay together. Do not give your food to anyone else. There is money sewn into your pockets if you need it, and my name and address too. She pins little name tags on their lapels.
Where are we going?
Anya asks. She's trying to be grown up. It is heartbreaking in one so young. At 5, she should be playing with dolls, not standing in line to leave her home. To the country. A summer park near the Luga River. You will be safe there, Anya, and in no time I will come for you. Vera plays with the tag pinned to Anya's lapel, as if touching the little piece of identification will help. Get on board, a comrade yells out. Now, the train is leaving. Vera hugs her daughter, and then her son, and then she straightens slowly, feeling as if her bones are breaking as she does it. Other people are handling her babies now, grabbing them, handing them to other people. They are crying and waving. Anya is holding Leo's hand. She shows her mama how tightly she is holding on, how strong she is being. And then they are gone. At first, Vera cannot make herself move. People push her out of the way, muttering desperate, feral curses. Do they not see that she is paralyzed, that she cannot move? Finally, someone pushes hard enough that she falls to her knees. She can feel children being handed off over her head, passed from one to another of the adults. Vera climbs slowly to her feet, noticing Dolly that her stockings have ripped at the knees. She moves aside, searching the train's windows,
starting to run from car to car until she realizes that her children are too little to be seen. So little. Has she told them everything? Keep your coat. Winter comes on fast, even though they say you'll be back in a week. Never be apart from each other. Brush your teeth. Eat your food, all of it, and get to the front of the line at every meal. Watch out for each other. I love you. At that, Vera stumbles, almost falls. She didn't tell them she loved them. She'd been afraid it would make them all cry harder, so she'd withheld the precious words, the only ones that really mattered. She makes a sound. The pain of it comes from someplace deep, deep inside, and it just erupts. Screaming, she shoves her way back into the crowd of people, elbows her way past women who stare at her with blank, desperate eyes. She fights her way to the train. "I am a non-essential worker," she says to the woman at the head of the line, who looks too tired to care. "Paperwork. I have dropped it in that mess," she says, indicating the crowd. The lie tastes bitter on her tongue and makes her sick to her stomach. It is the kind of thing that draws attention, and nothing, not even war, is as frightening as the attention of the secret police. She draws herself upright. "The workers are not controlling the evacuation. It is not efficient. Perhaps I should report this to someone." The criticism works. The tired woman straightens, nods briskly. "Yes, comrade, you are right. I will be more careful." "Good." Vera's heart is pounding in her chest as she walks past her into the train. At every step, she is certain that someone will come for her, yell "fraud!" and haul her away. But no one comes. And finally, she slows down, seeing the sea of children's faces around her. They are packed like sardines in the gray seats, bundled in coats and hats on this sunny summer's day. Proof that no one believes they'll be home in 2 weeks, although no one would dare say it. Their faces are round and sheened with tears or sweat. They are quiet. So quiet. No talking or laughing or playing. They just sit there looking broken and numb. There are a few women around. Evacuation workers, nursery school teachers, and probably some like Vera, who could neither let their children go nor defy an order of the state. She does not want to think about what she has done or what it will mean to her family. They desperately need the money she earns at the library. The train seems to waken beneath her. The whistle blows and she can feel it start to move, barely touching the seats. Unable to make eye contact with the children around her, she keeps going from one car to another.
"Mama!"
She hears Anya's voice spike above the rattling wheeze of the train. Vera claws her way forward to the small seat where her children sit huddled together, their heads too low to allow them to peer out the window. She slides into the seat, pulling them both onto her lap and smothering them with kisses. Leo's round face, wet with sweat and tears, is already dirty, although she cannot imagine how he made that happen. His eyes are damp with tears, but he doesn't cry this time. And Vera wonders if her goodbye did something to him, if now he is less innocent or not quite so young.
"You said we had to go."
Vera's throat feels so tight, it is all she can do to nod.
"I held his hand, Mama," Anya says solemnly. "Every minute."
Like all good Soviets, Vera does not allow herself to question the government. If Comrade Stalin wants to protect the children by taking them south, she puts them on the train. Her great act of defiance, going with them, seems like a small thing, and the farther she gets from Leningrad, the smaller it seems. She will see that they are safe at their destination, and when she knows that all is well, she will return to her job at the library. If she is lucky, it won't take more than a day or two. She will explain to her boss, Comrade Plotkin, that it was her patriotic duty to accompany the children on the state-mandated evacuation. Words matter here in the Soviet Union. Words like patriotic, efficient, essential. No one wants to question the wrong thing. If Vera can act certain and fearless, perhaps she will be okay. If only Mama will not worry too much. Or Olga.
Mama, I'm hungry, Leo says grumpily.
He is curled into her lap like a tiny fiddlehead fern, his stuffed gray bunny clutched in his arms. He is sucking his thumb and stroking the soft pink satin inside the rabbit's floppy ear. They have been on the train only a few hours, and no one has said a thing about meals or stopping or when they will arrive at their destination.
Soon, my little lion, Vera says, patting his padded shoulder.
She can see the way the children on the train are coming out of their numbness, growing restless. A few whine. Someone starts to cry. Vera is about to reach down for the small bag of raisins she has brought with her when the train's whistle shrieks. It doesn't stop this time. Doesn't blast once as if at a crossing and then go still. Instead, the sound goes on and on like a woman's scream. The brakes lock, making a grinding noise, and the train shudders in response, starts to slow. Gunfire erupts all around them. There is the whine of an airplane engine, and the explosions start. Vera looks outside, sees fire everywhere. Panic breaks out in the train. Everyone is screaming and running to the windows. A woman in a party shirt and wrinkled blue wool pants makes her way through the car saying, "Everyone off of the train! Go! To the barn behind us! Now!" Vera grabs her children and runs. It occurs to her later, when she is at the front of the line, that she is an adult, that she should have helped the unaccompanied children. But she is not thinking straight. The airplanes keep flying overhead. The bombs drop and fires start. Outside, all is smoke and screaming. She can hardly see anything but destruction. Burning buildings, black and smoldering holes in the ground, ruined houses. The Germans are here, pushing forward with their tanks and their guns and their bombs. Vera sees a man coming toward her. He is wearing an army uniform.
"Where are we?"
"About 40 kilometers south of the Luga River," he yells as he runs past her. She pulls her children in closer. They are crying now, their faces streaked with black. They run with the crowd to a giant barn and cram together inside. It is hot in here, and it smells of fear and fire and sweat. They can hear the airplanes overhead and feel the bombs that shake the ground.
"They took us right to the Germans," some woman says bitterly.
"Shh," comes at once from dozens of others. But it cannot be unsaid. The truth of it sticks in Vera's mind like a shred of metal and cannot be dislodged. All of these people, children mostly, waiting for a night that won't fall, for protection that may not come at all. How can you trust a leader who sends his country's children directly into the enemy? Thank God she is with them. What if they had been alone? She knows she will think this later, and for a long time. She will probably weep with relief. But later, now she must act. "We need to leave this barn," she says, quietly at first. But when another bomb hits close enough to rattle the rafters and send dust raining down on them, she says it again, louder. "We need to leave this barn. If a bomb hits us, citizen," someone says, "the party wants us here."
"Yes, but our children."
She does not say what is on her mind. She cannot. But many know anyway. She can see it in their eyes. "I am taking my children out of here. I will take anyone who wants to go." There is grumbling around her. She is hardly surprised. Her country is a place of great fear these days, and no one knows which is more likely to kill you, the Germans or the secret police. She tightens her hold on her children's hands and begins to move slowly through the crowd. Even the children ease sideways to let her pass. The eyes that meet hers are distrustful and afraid.
I will come with you, one woman says.
She is old and wrinkled, her gray hair hidden beneath a dirty kerchief. Four children stand clustered around her, dressed for winter, their pale faces streaked with ash. They are the only ones. Vera and the woman and their six children make their way out of the barn, past all the silent children. Outside, the countryside is gray with smoke.
We might as well start walking, the woman says.
How far are we from Leningrad? Vera asks, wondering if she has done the right thing. She feels exposed now, vulnerable to the airplanes flying overhead. To her left, a bomb falls and the building explodes.
About 90 kilometers, the woman says. It will do us no good to talk.
Vera hefts Leo into her arms and holds on to Anya. She knows that she will not be able to carry her son for long, but she wants to start out that way. Just in case. She can feel his strong, steady heartbeat against her own. In the years to come, she will forget the hardships of that journey. How her children's feet blistered until they bled. How their food ran out. How they slept in hay barns like criminals, listening all night for air raids and falling bombs. How they woke in a panic, thinking they'd been shot, feeling blindly for wounds that were not there. Instead, she will remember the lorry drivers who picked them up, and the people who stopped to give them bread and ask them what they'd seen down south. She will remember how she told them what she hadn't known before. That war is about fire and fear and bodies lying in ditches by the side of the road. By the time she gets home and stumbles into her mother's welcoming arms, she is battered and tired and bloody. Her shoes have worn through in places, and the pain in her feet will not ease, even in a pail of hot water. But none of this matters. Not now. What matters is Leningrad, her wonderful white city. The Germans are moving toward her home. Hitler has vowed to wipe this city off the map. Vera knows what she must do. Tomorrow, very early in the morning, she will get out of her narrow bed and dress in layers. She will pack all the sausage and dried fruit she can carry, and like thousands of other women her age, she will go south again to protect all that she loves. It is every citizen's job. We have to stop them at Luga, she says to her mother, whose face crumples in understanding. They need workers there. Mama does not ask why, or how, or why you. All of those answers are clear. It is only the first full week of war, and already Leningrad is becoming a city of women. Every man between 14 and 60 has gone to fight. Now the girls are going off to war, too.
I will take care of the children, is all her mother says. But Vera can hear "you come back to us" as clearly as if it had been spoken aloud.
I won't be gone long, Vera promises. The library will call me patriotic. All will be fine. Mama only nods. They both know it is a fiction, this promise of Vera's. But they say nothing. Both of them want to believe. 20.
I think that is enough for tonight, Mom said. Meredith was the first to stand. Moving almost cautiously, she crossed the small carpeted space and stood beside Mom. You don't look as tired tonight.
Acceptance, Mom said, staring down at her own hands.
The unexpected answer brought Nina to her feet. She moved in beside her sister. What do you mean by that?
You were right, Nina. Your father made me promise to tell you this story. I did not want to. And fighting a thing tires you out.
Is that why you went so crazy after Dad died? Meredith asked. Because you were ignoring his wishes?
That is perhaps one of the reasons, her mother said, giving a little shrug, as if to say that reasons didn't matter much.
Nina and Meredith stood there a moment longer, but whatever slim strand of intimacy had been created tonight was gone now. Again, Mom would barely make eye contact with them.
Okay, Meredith finally said. We'll come get you in the morning for breakfast.
I do not want
we do, Nina said in a voice that silenced her mother's protest. Tomorrow, the three of us are going to be together. You can discuss it, or argue, or yell at me, but you know that I won't change my mind, and in the end, I'll get my way.
She's right, Meredith said, smiling. She's a bitch when she doesn't get her way.
How would we know? Mom said.
Was that a joke? Nina said, grinning. It was like seeing the sun for the first time, or riding your first two-wheeler. The whole world suddenly brightened.
Go away, Mom said, but Nina could tell that she was trying not to smile with them, and just that little change gave Nina wings.
Come on, big sis, she said, slinging an arm around Meredith.
They left Mom's stateroom for their own room. Their long, narrow room was surprisingly spacious. There was a small sitting area, a love seat that made into a bed, a coffee table, a television, and two twin beds. A pair of sliding doors led to their private veranda. Nina turned on the television, which showed the ship's progress on a nautical map. There was no cell phone or internet service out here in the waters off British Columbia, and no television programming. If they wanted to watch a movie, they needed to borrow one from the ship's library.
Dibs on the bathroom, Meredith said as soon as they closed the door behind them. And Nina couldn't help laughing. It was a sentence straight from their youth. Meredith is on my side, Dad. Tell her to scoot over. Nina broke my Rock'em Sock'em robot on purpose.
Don't make me stop this car, you two.
Nina couldn't help smiling at that last one. When Meredith came out of the bathroom, looking squeaky clean and ready for bed in her pink flannel pajamas, Nina took her turn and got ready for bed. For the first time in years, she and her sister ended up in side-by-side twin beds.
You're smiling, Meredith said. I was just thinking about our camping trips.
Don't make me stop this car, Meredith said, and they both laughed.
For a magical moment, the years fell away. And they were kids again, fighting over an inch of space in the back seat of a bright red Cadillac convertible, with John Denver singing about being high in the mountains.
Mom never joined in, Meredith said, her smile fading.
How did she stay so quiet?
I always thought it was because she didn't give a shit. But now I wonder.
Dad was right. The fairy tale is changing everything. Nina nodded and leaned back.
The picture, she said after a moment.
It's Anya and Leo, right?
Probably.
Nina turned to look at her sister. The question that had been beside them all night, gathering weight and mass, was close now, impossible to ignore.
If Mom is really Vera, she said slowly, what happened to her children?
Nina had been all over the world, but rarely had she seen scenery to rival the magnificence of the inside passage. The water was a deep, mysterious blue, and there were islands everywhere, rough, forested hillocks of land that looked exactly as they had 200 years ago. Behind it all were rugged, snow-draped mountains.
She had come out early this morning and been rewarded with breathtaking shots of dawn breaking across the water. She caught an orca breaching off the bow of the ship, its giant black-and-white body a stark contrast to the bronzed early morning sky. She finally stopped shooting at about 7:30. By then, her hands were frozen, and her teeth were chattering so hard it was difficult to keep the camera steady. "Would you like some hot chocolate, ma'am?" Nina turned away from the railing and the exquisite view and found a fresh-faced young deck steward holding a tray of cups and a thermos of hot chocolate. It sounded so good she didn't even mind that the girl had called her ma'am. "That would be great, thanks." The steward smiled. "There are blankets on the deck chairs, too." "Does it ever get warm up here?" Nina asked, wrapping her cold fingers around the warm cup. "Maybe in August," the girl smiled. "It's beautiful in Alaska, but the climate isn't too friendly." Nina thanked the steward and went over to one of the wooden deck chairs. She scooped up a heavy plaid woolen blanket, swung it around her shoulders, and went back to the railing. There, she stared out at the sparkling blue water. A trio of dolphins swam alongside the ship, jumping and diving in perfect synchronicity. "That's a sign of good luck," Meredith said, coming up beside her. Nina opened one arm, let Meredith snuggle under the blanket beside her. "It's cold as hell out here, but beautiful." Up ahead, a lone lighthouse stood at the rugged green end of an island. "You were restless last night," Meredith said, reaching for Nina's hot chocolate. "How do you know?" "I'm an insomniac lately. It's one of the many prizes you find in the crackerjack box of a crumbling marriage. I'm always exhausted, and I never sleep. So why were you tossing and turning?" "We're 3 days away from Juno." "And?" "I found him." Meredith turned to her. The blanket slipped out of Nina's fingers and slid downward. "What do you mean, you found him?" "The professor of Russian studies, Dr. Adamovich. He's in a nursing home on Franklin Street in Juneau. I had my editor track him down." "So that's why we're on this cruise." "I should have guessed." "Did you speak to him?" "No." Meredith bit down on her lip and looked out at the water. "What are we supposed to do? Can we just show up at his door?"